Well, welcome back to Barred Window, and I'm delighted to tell you that I've got another podcast today from another poet that I like an awful lot, and this is Martin Porter. Now, Martin, welcome to the programme.
Hello, good to be here.
Now, as I said, your poetry is unusual, but it's very good. And I think that's about the bottom line that I think we're going to put on it. I'm going to put on it anyway. But I think people ought to listen to it for themselves. But just before we kind of get into things, what started you out in poetry? Just give us one or two little hints for a minute, and then we'll start reading.
Yeah, I was really lucky. I went to a primary school where my class teacher, for a couple of years, was actually a poet herself. So she encouraged us to write. We would write poems once a week. And that sort of sets you into the culture.
Okay. And I mean, can you remember some of your earliest stuff? Childhood, was there an interest there, or just you enjoyed the language?
I enjoyed writing it. I wasn't so keen on listening to it. So there's a peculiar dichotomy there. It's
okay. Well, go on. I mean, cut the video, would you, as well? Do you mind? And we'll just do it on audio.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. So many people talk about, you know, primary school. It's quite amazing, actually, just how many people were energized during that part of their lives that actually they kept the idea all the way through. Anyway, so primary school. But then can you remember when you wrote your first, what you would call a poem?
I was working on structure poems, the sort of formal poems of sort of A-B rhyming schemes in primary school. So when I was 9 or 10, I suppose. And by the time I was sort of getting to the end of secondary, I'd sort of started an interest in more free-form poetry and the crossover between poetry and prose.
All right. Well, come on, let's not hang about any longer and get the first poem that you're going to read to us. And this is 1 to 25,000 is the title of this poem, intriguingly. So would you like to say a little bit about it and then read it to us?
Yeah, 1 to 25,000 really typifies some of my approach, because it's the scale that you get in an Ordnance Survey map. Mm. So people who go walking with a paper map, in my day, we used to have to put it in a plastic bag, and we used to carry it around with us to make sure that we got the right styles and weren't shot at. So there's an interaction there between what you see on paper and what you see on the ground.
Okay.
And 1 in 25,000 is a reflection of what you see on a map and what you see on the ground and how you might address that in a poem. So here goes.
Yes, please.
Right, 1 to 25,000. Only slightly lost, we find the paper folded in an inside pocket. We are there, somewhere, 1 to 25,000, a mote of mobile imagining. And a trickle of blue splits the landscape. In the orange skein, we untangle a rolling surface pressed flat on the map, but filled with pebble, outcrop, blades of grass. On close scrutiny of the stylized code, a shrubby plantation catches the eye with its little lollipop trees springing from the rough green hummocks of a rough green pasture. And a trickle of blue splits the paper. On the ground, we find no deep black names. No red carpets are laid on our tracks. Hidden from the ink are the implicit sheep, the thin, abstracted cry of a curlew's mate, the wide, airy volume of the space, the loneliness, the unprintable emptiness of being there.
Yeah, there's so much in that poem. But we're going to leave our listeners to sort of reflect on it themselves, which will be, because it will be published as well as the podcast. I want to get as much of your poetry in as possible, Martin. So would you mind moving on and introducing our second poem?
Okay, New Descending Your Staircase number 2 is a Duchamp painting. And this is really a poem that relates to a painting. There's a few jokes tucked away in the painting. And I tried to tuck a few jokes into the poetry as well.
Okay.
So, for instance, if you go looking for New Descending a Staircase number 1, you might find that actually a little bit difficult.
I fell into that trap. I thought there was one. Anyway, go on. Right.
The other interesting thing about it, of course, is that it's really the start of an art movement. We're beginning to look at Cubism and that attempt to paint dynamism.
Which years are we talking about here?
I don't actually know. I would say it's sort of around First World War time.
Yeah, early 20th century, right, right.
Yeah, this is definitely a modernist painting.
Right. New Descending a Staircase number 2.
Rightio. New Descending a Staircase number 2. Even nudes have to get from one place to another. Sometimes this involves stairs. Treaders and risers, cubed and fashioned, arrayed, ascendant while stepping down. This is nothing new, no shift, just ignorance. And I've actually written different versions of this. One of the characteristics of my poetry is that I tend to spend a lot of time editing. I can spend hours editing a word. And in this poem, I've got several versions of this,
yeah.
None of which I'm totally happy with, but none of which I'm totally unhappy with.
Well, whatever one we publish up, I mean, I'm sure people will have their own opinion. I mean, but most of what I've got it in front of me here, and there's only one word different from what you said.
Which would be treaders and risers or treads and risers?
The last line you've got, I've got just movement.
Just movements, just ignorance. It's a very difficult edit, I find that one.
Poets listening to
just movement really plays. Just movement really plays about with the Duchamp idea, in that he is really painting at the start of a movement in art. Mm. So it makes the editing really difficult.
No, but cross-complementary kind of work, you know, in the sense that one art form to another is always rich, I found, you know, and in your case, you're reflecting what you see in a painting and what produced it. You know, I think that's great. I mean, generally speaking, I've got to say, though, Martin, and I ask all the guests this, poetry to me could be seen as still just a niche activity. You know, for a very small minority in the community, yet somehow or other, it is much more important than people realize. If you like, it's almost like kind of an undiscovered underbelly of life. It kind of reflects it so well that prose can't do sometimes. I mean, what's your view on the whole idea of you know where poetry sits within the sort of social psyche?
I'm absolutely fascinated by the way we treat language. I come from a scientific background, and scientists are often accused of speaking a foreign language. In fact, all we do is speak the language that's appropriate to our culture. And different cultures have different languages. But because each one of us lives within our own particular existence, our own particular culture, each one of us has our own particular understanding of what we read. Because when you stop to think about it, what you speak and what you read is simply a representation of something out there. And what I understand by that and what you understand by that isn't necessarily the same thing. So nude can represent one thing to one person, is something totally different to another.
Yeah.
Poetry, to my mind, you can really investigate these ambiguities, point them out to people, play with them. And to be quite honest, we operate in a poetic sphere when we speak, because we speak with rhythms, we speak with hidden rhyme. most of us like a rhyming language. It makes it easier to remember. So poetry
but most is definitely, yeah. Sorry, go on, finish.
Yeah, poetry is part of our substratum. It's part of our existence, really.
I think it's a primary part of the cultural landscape. In my view, it's as equal to many of the other art forms, if not all of them. But the way you mingled that, let's go on to your next one, because you've also done the same to actually write about Le Barreau Folies Bergères, Manet's picture. So could you read that one for us?
Yeah, I ought to mention, I absolutely adore this picture because it is such a disconcerting piece. And often people talk about the way the reflection is not an accurate reflection. The thing which I find really disturbing is in the top left-hand corner, there's a trapeze artist just hanging there. And for me, why he's there is really disturbing. There's an epigraph to this, which comes from Lost in Translation. And again, that reflects my view of language. I mean, everything we speak is a translation of what is out there. Yes. So Le Barreau Folies Bergères, Edward Manet, 1882.
Okay.
And from Sofia Coppola's Lost in Translation, Charlotte off screen says, "I'm stuck. Does it get easier?" Bob replies, "No, yes, it does." Caught between geometry and eternity, laced by fine fabric, cotton and holes, choker and paste, she does not say anything. It is, of course, a presaged cubist ploy. The reflection is one of disjunction, almost as if the artist is conniving with the chandeliered candlelight in order to multifacet the facts. Her reverie drifts around locked doors between hotel rooms, each with no connection to each with its own concealed presence, ill-defined fellows, fixating, conversing with the figments of her imagination possessed by another. She is empty among the full bottles. Her absent gaze has no sparkle wired into that concentration that is the beginning of grief and ends in the ellipsis of dialogue and understanding, inside space and lost exteriors. It does not get any easier.
Right, very, very helpful. Yeah, I like it a lot.
Yeah, again, there's variants of this poem.
Yeah, and you put the bit you sent to me was included the picture as well, so that was really helpful.
Yeah, it's a fabulous painting, absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. When did you write that?
Oh, that's about 20 years old. So we're looking at quite an old piece there. It was written before I migrated. I migrated in 2005 to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So that was quite a big move because I've been born and bred in Jersey. So moving from a small island to a bigger island is a bit of a shock to the system.
Well, yeah, no, I get it. I mean, I know some islanders and parts of Scotland, and you know, different ways sometimes of thinking about the world.
We are very insular. Islanders tend to go slightly rock crazy.
But people forget that you know, the UK is a giant archipelago. You know, we are full of islands.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, islands are what make up the world. I mean, if you think about it, since Pangaea, we've not really lived on a single continent or not really had a single continent on the planet. So we come from a highly dependent world.
Okay, listen, we've got to get some more in. So I've got a poem here that I know you're going to read, and it's called Pacifica, Queen Mab. Now, could you just do a very quick introduction and then let us hear it? Because it's one of the longer ones.
Yeah, Pacifica Queen Mab is a migration poem. So I basically am asking the question, what happens if you move something which is quintessentially British? In fact, Queen Mab is really set in our folklore into a completely different environment. And Pacifica Queen Mab sort of fell out while I was in New Zealand. There is an epigraph that goes with it, so I just mentioned that. It's from Romeo and Juliet, and it's not often read, actually. So it's, this is the hag when maids lie on their backs that presses them and learns them first to bear, making them women of good carriage. So this is Pacifica Queen Mab. Doping nocturnal moths, dry and empty in their brown winged shells, the densely sweetened perfume of Manuka hugs the ground, insinuating through the dreams of wood wasp in their paper cells. As day gives up her irksome work, the dark womb meets her need, and sultry through the musky heat, the moon rests in her cup and counts each starry glimmer as her seed. Phosphorescent seas collapse on broken shingle spits to sing of lost atolls, of matted rings of brittle rock, and henges built of mushrooms in the close-grazed fairy ring. The husks lie shattered on the moss, the gnats have long since flown, Atacop spins deadly wheels. There is no cricket wing. The open rides of lovers' hopes are long since overgrown. She does not trust the traveller, the rider on the ridge. She has no faith in whispered words, the secret tryst or pledge. She will not stride the open plains or creep along the ledge. She does not trust the stay-at-home, nor the fly-by-night. She has no faith in song and dance, the contract or the fight. She takes no comfort from the wren, nor fears the eagle in full flight. She is the witch of borderland. She is the sage of time. She is the aged sibyl, midwife of the troubled mind. She is the orphaned wanderer with no family, hound or kine. On a skiff of gilded darkness crafted from a lizard skin, she searches for companionship in dank ditches, rills, and brook. She rests bewildered, longing for her now ancestral kin. The heavy musk of twilight revisits her again. In loss, she finds acquaintance with the peace she craves, to drift to immolation like moth to candle flame.
Really amazingly, sort of the actual kind of images that sort of has thrown up. At the end of Mein Hing, there's a quote you put in by Shelley.
Yes, it's taken from Shelley's poem Queen Mab.
Queen Mab, yeah, which is what provoked you to think about this, isn't it?
There's quite a lot packed into this. I mean, again, it comes down to a painting as well. There's a painting called The Fairy Fellow's Carriage, I think it is.
Well, shall I quickly read that Shelley quote? Would it be all right?
Certainly, yes.
And it is yet permitted me to rend the veil of mortal frailty, that the spirit, clothed in its changeless purity, may know how soonest to accomplish the great end for which it hath its being, and may taste that peace which in the end all life will share. And that is, as you said, from Shelley's Queen Mab. Well, okay, Martin, that was really interesting. I mean, that sounds so neutral. No, it was really fascinating the way you actually dipped in and out of all sorts of imagery there in the poem. So again, I'm hoping that when people see it, they'll be even more able to dig in and find far more in there. I think you should be very proud of that one.
Yeah, I must certainly like that one.
But listen, you mentioned before, quite appropriately, that you originated from Jersey.
Yes.
And I do believe that the last poem we're going to read is relevant to that, called Islander. Is that, could you introduce that one a little bit?
Yes, Islander is it's a poem which is set in the Jersey archipelago. Jersey has some reefs offshore. One of them is the Ecrihó Reef. It's an interesting place to go. For one man, it was actually home for a while.
Oh.
A very, very peculiar place. It's significantly larger at low tide. At high tide, you really have to watch where you are, because it's easy to get caught on the wrong rock.
Okay.
So Islanders, it's very much based around that sort of rock and long sandy reef of the Ecrihó.
Right, okay. Well,
so Islander.
Yep.
And paddling from dinghy to shore, remembering sailors who wrote about shores and oceans green, rolling plains, touching those sentences, looking at strata, running my fingers along lines and discontinuities. These places are marginalia, rising from their own myth, creative with monsters and seabirds and islanders. I once pulled up my anchor and found, embedded in wave and strand and kelp, an old lobster pot, broken, no longer a trap. Today, I returned with poetry between my toes.
Very good. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I mean, you know, it must have been a different upbringing on Jersey, but at the same time, kind of fascinatingly different to some of us.
It's an extraordinarily privileged upbringing, because you are embedded within a culture, and the culture of Jersey, well, of course, it goes back to before the Norman Conquest. Mm. So the Norman Conquest, for most people on the English mainland, on the British mainland, is a conquest. For the Channel Islands, yes, it's a conquest, but it's a conquest the other way. It's us coming over to conquer. So it's a peculiar culture. It's wow. It's also a very very spoiled culture. It's certainly quite divided in some ways. So they're very rich on the island. There are people who are really quite hard up as well. So you feel these dichotomies. And I mentioned that I learned poetry at primary school. My primary school teacher was a lady called Florence Hackrell, and she was quite a capable poet, but wrote in Jersey French.
Oh, right.
So I've had these experiences of poetry written in a Jersey French dialect, and traditional French and English. And in New Zealand, of course, you would hear poets who had the rhythms of Te Reo Māori. So
there's a lot of big influences there.
It's an enormous blessing to me, because it's given me so many different views of the world.
Well, Martin, unfortunately, though, you've just given yourself a hostage to fortune, because people will be searching out your work on all these subjects and trying to find out where they can get a hold of any more of your work. Are there any places at the moment, or are you just compiling things?
I tend not to publish in my own right, but I'm happy to submit occasionally.
Right.
So there are poems available in print, but also on the net. Anyone who's got copies of the Interpreter's House will find a copy contains New Descending a Staircase number 2 in one edition.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's say this. Let's say that in the text at the front of the podcast, you know, I'll put all links that you'd like, so to help people find your work.
Yeah, I'll pop in some links and give people some of the insights into what's happening in New Zealand as well.
Oh, that would be really good. I'd appreciate that. That would be excellent, because I've got no personally poetic content with New Zealand, so it'd be a brand new landscape for me. I'd love that.
Yeah, it's an exciting place.
Okay. Well, look, Martin, thanks ever so much for being on Barred Window. I hope I know you'll be putting the poems you've read up for people to see, but at the same time, we'll put a lot of contact details and information about yourself on the front. And I know I'll be seeing you anyway in the not too distant future, but I hope that people can also pick up any new work that you think's okay to put on the site in the future, and maybe one day have you back again. So thank you very much indeed for being on the program.
Oh, that's excellent. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope people enjoy it.
Okay, well, I'm sure they will. Well, stop it now, and thanks ever so much.
Thank you.